I'm very pleased to welcome to Paintbox J, one of the most wonderful legendary photographers alive today, J Stock. J is one of the few living members of the Photographic Hall of Fame. The Professional Photographers of America have awarded him with their Master of Photography and Photographic Craftsman degrees, as well as their Professional Photographers National Service Award. He's a fellow of the American Society of Professional Photographers, the British Institute of Professional Photography, and Britain's Royal Society of Arts. In addition, J was the premier recipient of the American Society of Photographers International Award and Eastman Kodak's Steuben Crystal Apple Award and the Professional Photographers of California's Award of Excellence. On top of all of that, in 1975, Jay became the first photographer to exhibit his work at the United States Capitol Building. And this exhibit consisted of more than 125 limited edition prints, which included studies of African, European, and Native American peoples. A portion of this exhibition, entitled Faces of Today's American Indian, was exhibited at the White House. And I really recommend for anybody listening that they go to Jay's website, which is www. jstock.com, and you'll just get a little idea there. He's put on a small sampling of his incredible imagery. And in part two of this interview, Jay is actually going to refer to some specific photographs that are featured in some of the galleries on his website. So that'll be very interesting for you to be able to refer to them while you're listening. On a personal note, I should also just add that for me, Jay is one of the most special people in my life. He's been an incredible joy to get to know, and I value Jay incredibly as a wonderful friend and an inspiration. And so, Jay, I also want to take this opportunity before we dive into your story just to thank you. Just for being such an inspiration to me, and also I know to so many other people around the world.
Well, thanks, Jeremy. I'm just pleased to do this, man. This is wonderful.
Well, I've, so interested to learn about, your incredible life, and I know that a lot of the people listening as well, will, be able to learn so much from your experience and what you've been through and your story. So, without further ado, Jay, if you could just sort of guide us through your life and fill us in as to, how, where you, grew up, and tell us a little bit about your family and your childhood.
Good. You want me to just start?
Yep. Why don't you just dive in at the beginning and we'll go from there. We'll let it flow.
Well, good. This all happened around noon on this 26th. 27th day of June in 1923. That's when I entered this beautiful world. And I've been out here now for going on 86 years. I was born in a little town in Ohio called Dillondale. It's a small town, about 500 people, and it's a coal mining and railroad community. My dad had four brothers, and he was the oldest, and he comes from a coal mine, from a farmer's family. And when he was 5 years old, he came to this country from Austria-Hungary. My mom was has 14 brothers and sisters, and from her family's background was coal mining. So my dad was a railroader, and he worked the railroads working the coal mines. I had one sister who is and four brothers. I am the oldest boy. My sister was 2 years older than I was, and she passed away at age 59. And two of my younger brothers have also crossed over, one at 57 and one at 75. I now have two younger brothers, one at 70, one at 65. My mom died in 1952 at 49 years of age, and my dad died 6 months later at 59. They both died in the same year. I remember my childhood perfectly, and it was a busy one. Being the oldest boy and growing up in a depression period, most of the of the work landed on my shoulders since I was the oldest boy. The time of my life required many jobs for me because we were very poor and we had a large family. Things were not plentiful. We had plenty to eat, but they were not as they are today. I had to do a lot of work. I loved ones, and we lived near a railroad track, right near our home was near a railroad track where the railroad had put cars and set them there on our way to the coal tipples and the coal mines to be filled up with coal. And one of my jobs was to be climb into those big, huge coal cars and throw out any chunks of coal that was left in them because we heated our home with coal. And it was my job to gather all the coal all year round so my father would not have to buy any coal for our home, which was heated with coal. For wood, I gathered old railroad ties and sawed them up in 1 foot length and then splintered them into kindling wood that we used to start fires in our coal stoves. My other job was to spade our garden and plant all types of vegetables, and it was my job to work to weed the garden. For milk, we owned a cow, and it shared our garage. For the hay, I had to gather it up in the fields that farmers cut hay around and was left on the sides. The fields were all the neighbors had cows, so everyone gathered hay for the winter feeding. We raised chicken for fresh eggs and for chickens to eat, chicken meat. We also had a couple of pigs for winter slaughter, where we almost were self-sustaining. Being the oldest boy, I had to do all the work around the house and keep the cars clean, but the bright side of all this was I did wash cars and waxed them for extra money that I could use for myself. I also remember helping my mother, my mother's parents' family, with raising all sorts of food and livestock. They raised geese, and that was used for bed coverings in the wintertime, where we could have large containers filled with geese feathers, and we called those feather ticks. At one time, there was no bakery in those days, so everyone baked bread, and my parents purchased flour and sugar in 50 and 100-pound sacks. I can remember it like today. I can also remember that my underwear was made from these flour and sugar sacks. We also put all sorts of meat and vegetables in jars for winter eating. Our little town had mostly ethnic people, and we had just four churches, Catholic, Protestant variations, and two schools, Catholic and a public school. I went to the Catholic school for 8 years and then to the public high school for high school. Everyone knew everyone, and there was no trouble in the high school. I started to draw and paint, and I loved the town because it was surrounded by three large coal mines and two railroads and where my father worked and how we made the money to exist. And later would be part of my life, that railroad would. I graduated before my grandparents on my dad's side had a farm. And as a boy, we used to go up to the farm every Sunday where we had a large family gathering. And my grandmother used to get fresh chicken, and we had fresh chicken every Sunday to eat. And we would sit all day out under the cherry trees in the front yard and talk. It was a time for family get-together. Until milking time. Milking time, the cows would come in, and everybody in the family, my dad and his brothers, had to milk the cows. And it was that way all summer when I had an opportunity to share a lot of good times on that farm as a little boy, picking blackberries and picking raspberries and watching them as they cut hay and put it into the barns in the old-fashioned way. And I wish I had a camera because I can remember those things so plainly today. And if I was, I would have so many wonderful and beautiful images. Maybe I love going to the Amish community because the Amish community still works somewhat the same old way as they did many years ago. So my life with both of my grandparents was wonderful. I enjoyed them. I loved them. I spent as much time with them as I could. They were very poor and existed just by hard work. So that's how we lived in those days, you know, in the late 20s and 30s. In 1941, I graduated from high school, and a month later, I moved to Cleveland. there to work in a defense plant. Something must have been happening. I think things were moving in Germany with Adolf Hitler. So defense plants grew up all over the United States. And I went to Cleveland to get a job in one of those plants. And we manufactured war equipment for tanks and planes. Cleveland was 2.5 hours from my home, and gas was rationed, so I could not get home to visit as much as I wanted to, because I had a very close family tie. Eventually, I was drafted into the Army and was sent to Texas for my basic training. And after that, I was shipped overseas. The Aleutian Islands is where I ended up, a lonely and barren area close to Japan proper, where two invasions were there on Attu and Kiska. I was a medical aid man attached to an infantry outfit. I was stationed overseas for 37 months. And how I got into photography was being sent to a rest camp in Alaska from the islands. And there the government had set up a dark room at the hotel where we all went to get rested up and furnished with paper and chemicals and offered you a chance to learn to develop film and print. But I had no camera. But I learned to print pictures anyway. And then I would borrow a camera from one of the other people who were there and got into the dark room and learned to process and print. I was interested. I was hooked. I wanted more, and I wanted to carry it further.
What sort of things did you photograph when you were in Alaska?
I photographed scenes, and I photographed some other people, other photographers. And I started a little business, like I would develop film and print it for them, and I would sell them the images. So I did that, and then there were some wild animals that I photographed, like goats and mountain goats and that sort of stuff. It was a beautiful, beautiful country. It was just absolutely gorgeous. And from there, I was shipped back to a rest camp in the United States, and I went to Georgia. And while I was in Georgia, it was the last. I remember now that I never got any of my negatives that I made while I was in overseas. I was told that I was going to a rest camp in the States and I would be taken back to the islands. However, when I was home, the war was over and there was no need for my return. So I lost all my negatives and all my prints that I had made the first part of my photographic life.
The ones that you left in Alaska, the rest camp there, you mean?
Yes, I did. I left them in the rest camp area, right. And I don't know whatever happened to them, but there was a lot of good negatives and a lot of good prints, but I received nothing. I got nothing back. Upon discharge from the Army, I immediately got home and got a job in the coal mines. Coal mine jobs were always open. So I soon got married to a lovely lady that I met while home on leave. After marriage, we moved into a small three-room house that was a playhouse. It was so small that it was a playhouse for the owner's daughter from the people where we rented. Outside, restrooms, no running water, and coal-burning stoves and fireplaces. That's all the changes we had. That all changed when my wife became pregnant, however. We decided to move back with her parents, where the facilities was a little bit better. I soon discovered that I did not want to go to spend the rest of my life in the coal mines. And at that time, the state of Ohio was giving us veterans $400 bonus to all people who served in the Second World War. So I got my bonus, and I wanted to go into photography, so I purchased a 4x5 speed graphic, some film holders, a tripod, enlarger, trays, and two 10-inch photo flood reflectors that I still have. I still have them, and I use them occasionally for other things. And then I could take pictures. My studios were the living room of my customers, and I was doing First Communion groups and all local Catholic churches and schools, and, of course, I started to do candid weddings, which were new at that particular time. My dark room was our kitchen. So after my wife had cook dinner and clean the kitchen table and clean the kitchen up, I would pull the shades down into the kitchen, bring out the enlarger, put the trays on the kitchen table, and start processing my film and making prints. I continued working in the coal mines while I was doing all this. I just wanted to get as much experience as I could in photography. Well, an opportunity an opportunity came up for me to get a job as a fireman on the steam engines on the railroad. So I went to work on the railroad. However, railroads were seasoned work at that time. So with seasonal, I mean, I got a job because a lot of coal was being shipped into the Great Lakes area, and a lot of iron ore was being shipped to the steel mills. And once the lakes froze up, were with ice, and no coal iron ore was being shipped in, I was furloughed. And from there, I went back to the coal mines. With camera in hand, I would carry my speed graphic and flash bulbs into the coal mine to photograph workers being done in that mine. I got some great pictures of that of people working in a mine in the 1940s and 50s. The camera to photograph, I even used my camera, carried it with me on the railroad, and together I put a smart portfolio of groups of men who were working in the coal in the railroads, along with I photographed all the engines, steam engines. I finally decided with my wife's blessing that the future looked better in the photography profession than it would in the coal mining and railroad. And since I already was furloughed from the railroad, I decided to take a leave of absence so I could go to photography school in New Haven, Connecticut, under the GI Bill of Rights. My wife, as I at that time, we had two small daughters, and her staying with my in-laws seemed like a safe place for them. An application to the Progressive School of Photography in New Haven, Connecticut, was approved under the GI Bill of Rights, so we decided to do it. I left my family and my wife with her parents, and my youngest daughter at that time was 5 months old, and my oldest was 18 months old. I had no money, and the government sent checks to my wife monthly and paid for my education, including room. I shared a room with three other GIs, and we had a hot plate to cook on. We bought two-day-old bread, 50 and 100-pound sacks of potatoes, and we ate a lot of hot dogs. I missed my wife and my two small children. My only communication with them was by mail and by letters. Phones were too expensive, there was no money for us to do that. So when I needed the money to buy food, I would go to the local hospital and sell my blood. I remember the first Christmas I was away at New Haven, Connecticut. I couldn't go home since we had no money for bus fare. And I now reflect, it was not only I, but my wife, my in-laws, and my children who sacrificed so much for the life I wanted to do and be in photography. The school was great. I spent as many hours working as possible, retouching and doing everything that I could do to enhance my education in photography. Our instructors were great photographers, but the greatest challenge came from the photographers who came from New York City to lecture for us. I'm sorry that some of these lecturers was like noted photographers like Philippe Hoffman and great other names. One name I recall like it was yesterday is a man by the name of Victor Kepler, who told us that when we had his first camera, he had only one light, and that single light was a 60-watt light bulb on an extension cord. And that was great eye-opener for me. And when I realized what he had meant in that statement, I started at once to connect with the old master painters who became my very mentors. I began to visit museums and study their work and to read about their life, which was so much different and important than the artwork itself. I think you should read about the person because it tells you a lot more than just looking at their imagery. I remember going into a museum and studying the work of Rembrandt, where I spent time with a mound of light studying the key and the way the light was all so wonderfully painted on him, and all the emphasis went on the face. I had practiced the vignetting of light with barn doors to give me the same effect that Rembrandt produced in his low-key paintings. It was about contrast. It was about the handling of light between face, clothes, and everything else. It was so beautifully done that my first work happened to be in the low-key area. After all, we do not really photograph anything except light anyway, and where it falls. When school was over, I went back to my family for a happy reunion and back to the coal mines, and as a means of support, then all the plans were made for the studio work. That's it, Jeremy. We go into page into the second program after that.
That's right. I had a couple of questions just out of curiosity. One of them, when you were in the mines, I know it may seem a naive question, but were you actually, you know, you were physically at the coal face, chipping away at the coal? I mean, you know, pretty much sort of physically chipping out the coal?
Yes.
So, I mean, that must have been incredibly physically demanding work, I would imagine. I mean, you know.
It was. It wasn't very, I mean, the space in which to work is not very high. Maybe at that particular time when I went into the coal mine, there was only about 4 foot height. So we always was bent over and working on our knees. And when I go now into the West Virginia coal mines to photograph the miners down there, the coal is only 31 inches high. So rest of it is stone above it, and they keep that stone there. So when they go into the mine to work, the coal miners lay flat on their back on a piece of a machinery, and they're hauled in laying flat on their back. And when they go to work in the mines, they're working on their hands and knees.
Oh, my gosh. And, I mean, how dangerous was it? Did you, because even today, you know, we hear of these accidents from time to time and tragedies. When you were working in the coal mine, I mean, was it similarly sort of a very, very high-risk profession?
Yes, it was. There was a lot of people getting injured, many accidents and many coal miners getting killed. The safety at that, you know, we're talking about in the 1940s and 1950s, mm-hmm. compared to now, which is 60 years ago. The safety programs today they have in the mines, it's much better, and very seldom now the people do get killed, or there is some major. It has to be something very major to cause some damage to some physical problems to some other people. Except of course, when the mines blow up or the big cave-ins occur, then the people get trapped in the mines, and that's a little bit different than the normal work, though.
Right, right. Very, very, very interesting. You mentioned that going back, you know, when you were a child, that you did used to do some drawing and painting. What sort of things did you draw and paint? Were they from your imagination, or did you draw and paint things you saw around you as a child? Or?
As a child, my first thing that I started to draw would be maps, a design of the maps of the world, mm-hmm. like North and South America and Africa and Europe. That was the first thing I started to draw.
Like copying maps from atlases, things like that?
Right, right, yeah, from geography books.
Huh.
Yeah, yes, and I would just sit there and sketch with crayons and pencils and doing that. And then I decided to go into art books, not art books, but regular books, and copy any, not copy, but sketch from next to anything that was in there. And if there was a color calendar or anything that I could get a hold of, then I would try to draw what's on that calendar and color it in with crayons or watercolors. That was my first thing in drawing. And comic books at that time was a big big thing, because there was a lot of comic books out, and they were all in color, and you could draw and sketch characters from those things, and you could work them in with crayons or with watercolors.
Very interesting. Do you think that your interest in photography, I mean, was influenced by your early drawing and painting, and I mean, do you think that reflected in later life on
yes,
what you
it
did?
Was. Yes, it was. My photography came to being because of my love for art, for drawing and painting. And then when I first got the opportunity to go to the museums and buy art books, since then and to this day today, I am always buying, purchasing, and going to art books and studying about the painters themselves and going to art museums and spending a lot of time in an art museum. I don't just go there and walk through. I may pick out one person's work, whether it be whoever it might be, whether it's an impressionist painter or an American painter, or it'd be one of the old master painters, Rubin or whatever. And I would stay in that room, and I would look at every one of them, and I would study the painting in its whole entirety. I would study the values of light. Where did it fall off and why? That I could see in my mind how the painter lit the subject matter as a photographer would. And I could see that happening. And that's where I spend a lot of time into studying art and going into museums. And I would recommend that for anybody. I think the most basic thing that they're going to create good photography is to create good art and to understand art, because some art becomes everything. Art is so involved in every facet of our life today, no matter what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, you know. Huh?
I think that's excellent advice, and you know, something that everybody can benefit from, taking the time to visit museums and galleries and study original paintings.
Oh, yes. Study all of it, no matter how good or how bad it is. You know, you got to study it, because it tells you what you want to do and what you don't want to do. So it has a great interesting thing to depend on. As we go into second and third of our programs, I will talk more about this so that people can understand where I'm coming from also on this, because it's to me, my teachers, my old teachers, are the artists, the painters. They're the ones, they're my mentors.
You mean Rembrandt and the old masters?
All of them. Rockwell, Rembrandt, the Impressionist painters. I got so much from these. I have learned so much from all of these painters, you know, that I find that no matter what. In fact, one of our great painters, of American painters, just passed away not too long ago, and that's Andrew Wyeth, who I felt was the greatest American painter alive. And I studied and visited his work in Maine, no matter where I'd go there, and I just, as I will tell you in other projects, what I've done up there. So there's a lot of things happening in the art world that I was connected to, and because my connection with the art world left me wide open to learn so much about my photography.
Very, very interesting. And then as you take photographs and light a subject, do you sometimes in your mind's eye visualize particular paintings and think, I want to get this or that sort of light?
I do. I work very, very difficult. It's very hard for me I work very hard trying to create a light source that's going to give me a feeling, whether I'm working in low key, middle key, or high key. I want that be very explicit to me. I want people to really understand why they should work at this. You know, light is light. And when I say we photograph only light, if we didn't have any light and took a person and sent them down the dark room, we can't photograph it. We have to have light. So with this light is what we photograph. And how we handle the light is our image on our negatives, which eventually winds up on a piece of paper, and we call it our photograph. So light is so important, plus composition, plus space, all of these things are so important in creating photography. And I got all of that from the old master painters.
Very, very interesting. And do you find that you prefer to use natural light outdoors, or you it depends on the situation? I mean, I know in your studio work, obviously you're controlling the lighting with artificial lighting, but how do you strike that balance between using natural light versus using artificial light?
Well, when I'm outdoors photographing and I use the normal light source that's out there, I learned from the masters again. When was the best time for them to take this light? You know, when was the best time that they made to create this? How did they create the ratios? How did they get bright backgrounds and low key into shaded areas? I got all of that from the art books and from the old master painters. And this is where I studied all of my work. All of my work is based on art. It's that doesn't mean that I don't admire a lot of photographers, because I do. And I did study with several of them in certain areas, which I'll cover in other segments here. But the important thing about understanding, if you like somebody's artwork as a painter, then you got to find out why they did it. This is why when you read art books, that looking at the imagery doesn't always give you the answers. You have to read the text of the book, and the text in the book will tell you how that artist felt and why he painted what he did paint, and why, and what came, and you can look and see what became of it. So sometimes, you know, well, I may go clear off the board. I may work with a ratio of light outdoors that's seven stops or eight stops difference, and which is almost unheard of in photography. But when you begin to understand what that ratio of light can do in a photograph for you, then it's easy to understand how you can make those kind of images.
When you say ratio of light, you mean ratio of the darks to the lights in the
composition? The highlights to the shadows, yes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I go six, seven stops difference. My meter is in my hand all the time when I'm working outdoors. It's continually in my hand. I'm reading highlights and shadows because I know what my want my in my mind. I know what work I'm duplicating. I know what my how I want my work to be. So I'm continually using this all the time to create that kind of artwork.
Very, very interesting. And what about the aspect of storytelling through photography? Because did your teachers at the New Hampshire School sort of address this in terms of the importance of storytelling, and how important is that in your own work?
Well, the things that was emphasized to me when I went to school in New Haven, Connecticut, which was on Yale campus, it was part of Yale School, but it was a separate entity. These were illustrators. Now, if you're familiar with illustrators, their paintings are done to create a cover for a magazine or for whatever, and it's a storytelling image. And what I learned from Kepler and Halsman and all these guys who lectured to us was that, especially with Rockwell, you look at his Saturday Evening Post magazines, and they're all storytelling. I mean, you can look at one image, and you can see Christmas, or you can see Thanksgiving, or you can see a 4th of July, or you can see everything, because it's all created to one interest that's there, is done on that one painting. Now, what I tried to do is to do stories. Each one of my photographs, I want them to tell a story, which when we get into, I think, part three or part two of this lecture, I'll be able to explain to the people that's listening to this why I do this. And it shows, if they go and look at my website, they'll be able to see those images that I pulled up and explain to them.
Very, very interesting. And one other thing that I was just curious about that you mentioned that one of the things that struck you about Victor Kepler was that he used just a single 60-watt light bulb. And so what was it that about that fact that was so influential for you and so dramatic? Maybe if you could explain a little bit more about why was that something that made such an impact on you?
Yes, yes. Well, Victor Kepler was the guy that said, he didn't say he used it all the time. He said when he got his first camera, that's the only light he had, was a 60-watt light bulb. So then I started putting two to two together, and I started working a lot with candles. And there's a very small of light that comes from a candle, but you can light a subject with a candle. You can light a subject with a match. And if you go back to the artist work of Vermeer, you will see that he did a lot of work with candles, and he had a reflector behind that candle that would light a subject for him. So, you know, I found out that you don't need a lot of light, like in today's photography. There's so much light out there with the digital world that everything has begun to be washed out. There's no highlights, there's no shadows, there's no shape, or just light. And we need to go back to learn to understand what light does. So the easiest way to do that is to take a simple candle or take a lamp or take a simple light source and work with this. You can take one light, a 60-watt light bulb, a 40-watt light bulb on a lamp in your room, and you can move it around to create anything, any kind of light you want. You can create an extreme light, a small amount of light. You can create deep shadows. You can create soft light. And you can learn to see what one light does for you. And once you learn what one light does for you, then you're free to go and do anything you want because you have that cool understanding of ratio of light, strength of light, the density of light, and the color of light. That all comes out just by understanding what one light will do for you.
That reminds me of painting and the power of just exploring the range of marks you can make with a single tool, whatever it is, a crayon, a brush, whatever it is. And, you know, to rather than try lots and lots and lots of different tools, start off by just experimenting with one tool and see how far you can push the dynamic range.
Well, see, you do that in your paintings, and I know that. See, that's why you're such a good you're a good digital man, or whatever you call yourself. You're a photographer, you're a digital man, you're everything. You're a lot of stuff. You're a painter, you're a lot of things. And that's what makes you so unique, is because you are one of the very few men that I admire for the kind of work you do with a digital, with computers, because you do it so well. And you do it well because you understand it.
Well, thank you. And I treat it just like with I would with a non-digital medium.
Well, it's that way with anything. Yep. As long as you understand light, then you can create anything you want. So I would recommend to everybody, as I always do anyway, is to take one lamp, you know, and if you use film, take a couple rolls of film, take it in a house, put it in one corner, just move that light around. Just keep moving it and see what happens to your subject with only one light. And then you begin to understand a lot. Now, you take one light in a room from a lamp cord or a reflection or whatever, it works the same way as you only used one window, except the light is broader again, but you get the same kind of effect, only it's not as sharp and confined with a one single light bulb as it is with a big 6-foot window. But basically, it works all the same.
Very, very interesting. The other thing that I think is interesting that I sort of notice in your work is the use of very selective focus and focal planes. And I think that I'd be interested to know, you know, your thoughts and reflections on, the importance of that versus what happens a lot in digital is that so much is in focus. And I think that the challenge in some ways is being more selective. But I just wonder if you had any thoughts on that subject.
Well, it still goes back to the art books. You go back to the museums and you study art. The motif, the number one subject. They can have 10 people in a painting. The number one is the sharpest. The rest of them, as the density of light falls off and the depth of field falls off, they become slightly more out of focus. I don't care which one you look at. I don't care which one you study. There's not 20 people on there, and they're ranging from 1 foot to 10 feet and all in sharp focus. That's one of the bad things I think about digital, is the fact that, you know, all of this stuff is in sharp focus, and it's just not the way you see them. You know, in painting, you study the paintings, you'll find out the solemn light and the depth of focus. I think the depth of focus is one of the most important things, because you've got three ways to focus: front, middle, and back. And if you focus on the front, behind it is going to go out of focus. If you focus in the middle, the front's going to be out and the back's going to be out. And if you focus at the back end of it, everything in front of that back end is out of focus, and everything behind it is in sharp focus. So it's important that you use the three points of focus, front, middle, and back.
Right. Very, very much so. And when you were starting off, with your photographic career, could you just describe a little bit about the equipment you used in terms of your camera?
Yes, that's in other parts of my lecture.
Ah, that's going to be in our next installment, which actually this is a perfect time then to draw our first installment to a close. And thank you, Jay, so much indeed for just sharing your incredible story. And I'm sure our listeners are going to look forward to part two coming up, which continues where we're leaving off.
Yeah, it'll be part two coming up, and then there'll be part three after that. So there's two other segments that I've tried to explain everything in there. Now, one of the things I can tell your listeners, Jeremy, is that if they don't understand anything I'm talking about, just call me.
And they can get your information from your website, right?
jstock.com. Right, the website, yes. They could go to my website. It tells everything that I do, everything that I've done. And it shows a whole series of portfolios in there, outdoors and indoors, and the scenics, everything done. And they can see everything we talk about in those imagery.
That's wonderful. Well, we'll look forward to the other parts of this interview. And again, Jay, this has been such an honor for you to share all this insight with us. So thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it.
Well, I just wanted people to know that if you love something, you know, the sacrifice that you have to make is a big one. And me and my family did a lot of sacrificing along the way. You know, and I worked three jobs for 14 years of my life, and I think that that's very important if you want to really want to reach a goal with a strong objective in mind. If you want to get there, it's going to take work to get there. If you don't want to get there, then you're not going to get there. It's that simple.